National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The only Christian parish in Gaza, Holy Family, is still trying to recover from a strike by Israeli forces, the IDF, this week. What are the implications of the attack for Christians in Gaza and beyond? This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Ambassador Alberto Fernandez with his analysis. And then, there's quite a bit of discussion about the theological term deification, or theosis. Register Senior Editor Jonathan Liddle joins us. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm joined, as always, by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Hello, Shannon.
Hello, Matthew.
The news, it used to be that summers were fairly quiet.
Not this summer. Anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world, exactly. Well, as we record, in fact, this episode of Register Radio, Holy Family Church in Gaza continues to try and recover from a strike by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, that left at least two dead, others injured, and its pastor, Father Gabriel Romanelli, wounded by shrapnel in his leg. The Holy Family Church is considered the last Christian refuge in Gaza, where dozens of families have been sheltering since the outbreak of the war in October 2023. To unpack all of this and to assess the wider ramifications, not just of this attack, but to understand where we are exactly in this war in Gaza, we're joined by Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, who, among his many, many accomplishments, he is also a Register contributor and a contributor for EWTN News. Ambassador, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be on with you guys.
Well, here we are. We had you on a few weeks ago talking about, I think it was the Iran crisis, and here you are back again talking about another tragic event in the Middle East, in this case in Gaza. What was your reaction when you heard the news? Because this is certainly, for Christians in the area, a very surprising and horrifying event.
Well, it was very sad, especially when one heard that there were actually casualties. The death toll is now up to three confirmed dead, and looks like 14 injured, at least a couple of them seriously. And shock, especially because, of course, the parish was attacked before, earlier in the war, last year. And some people were killed and injured back then. So it's a very, very sad situation. You know, there's so few Christians left in the region, and particularly in Gaza. So one loss is tremendous. It's a tragedy, but it's a tragedy for a community which has suffered so much.
Alberto, essentially the geography, the lay of the land here, there is the church building. This is Holy Family Parish. And then there's a compound. As Matthew said at the outset, there's dozens of families, I think well over 100. These are local Christians who have sheltered there. I gather from the really beginning of the Israeli attacks there. So what is their life like? I mean, how are they able to even remain there in this compound?
Well, the compound is, as you can imagine, as we're very familiar with our own parishes, is the church building, the sanctuary, and a school and administrative building. And it's not far from the ancient Orthodox Church, St. Porphyrios. And in fact, that ancient Orthodox Church is very small and doesn't have a compound. And so actually, the Orthodox also are sheltering at the Catholic parish. And sadly, of course, two of the dead are Orthodox brethren. Looks like the third was the janitor of the church. So it's a place where people have found a bit of refuge outside the destruction of Gaza City going on outside, the war raging outside. But it's, of course, in such dynamic situations, it's a tenuous refuge.
Yeah, the priest in this parish, Father Romanelli, was the recipient almost every day of a phone call from Pope Francis. What have we seen from Pope Leo so far?
Well, Pope Leo issued a statement. There was a statement issued through the Secretary of State, through Cardinal Parolin, obviously condemning it and expressing sympathy with the victims and calling for an immediate ceasefire, which, of course, is a consistent position of the Vatican under our current Pope and under Pope Francis as well, that the war should stop and that the violence should stop. So that's very much consistent with what the Holy See has said previously.
Yeah, we've also gotten, I know, an apology of sorts from the Israeli Defense Forces, from the Israeli government. What are we to attach in terms of their response to the news?
Well, there was a statement from the Foreign Ministry, an official statement expressing regret at the damage and the loss of life from the Israeli government. And basically saying, and I think the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have said the same thing, that they're going to investigate the incident and tell us what actually happened. This is, of course, within the context of a volatile situation in Gaza where Israel has triumphed over Hamas, the terrorist group Hamas that started this war on October 7th, 2023. But we're in kind of the end stage, end game situation. And Israel confronts a confusing and bitter reality, which is, how does this war end? Under what conditions, under what reality? Do they stand down? Do they ramp up? There are still hostages, still Israeli hostages being held. The Gaza Strip has, largely been demolished, much of it. People are dependent on outside aid. So the end game, this is part of a very kind of volatile, dynamic, and unfortunately sometimes bloody end game.
Yeah, Alberto, when we here in the West see photos of Gaza, I mean, it looks like a hellscape, right? It's just a field of rubble, and at least in many parts to it. It doesn't seem to be much left to attack, but of course we're not seeing this vast network of underground tunnels. Is that what is still the focus of the fighting there?
Well, that's part of it. And, of course, the Israelis face the challenge that they're fighting an adversary, which is not a, straight military. It's a terrorist group or insurgent group or guerrilla group. So it's hit and run. It's groups that hide in the rubble, not just in tunnels, but in the rubble of buildings. So, it's the dilemma that forces face throughout the world when they're engaged in warfare in highly populated urban landscapes. You clear an area, you clear a building, and the terrorists or the insurgents, whatever you call them, move back in and reoccupy that space and maybe set booby traps and try to get behind you. So you don't know who's friend, who's foe, who's a civilian, who's not a civilian. Hamas mostly doesn't wear uniforms. So it's a perfect scenario unfortunately, for friendly fire and for mistakes to be made, and to be fighting in such a close-in, built-up environment.
And within that context, as you note, facing obvious nonlinear warfare, what could possibly have happened that led to this strike on Holy Family? To just sort of speculate, I hate to ask you to do that, but it seems if it was a tank involved or whatever the weapons that were used, was this deliberate in your view, or was this a genuine accident?
Well, I mean, in most cases, one would think that firing directly on a church, knowing it's a church, is usually not deliberate. That is, I think, mm-hmm. true not just in Israel. That's true in most situations. Mm-hmm. We don't know. Obviously, there could have been threat information. There could have been fire from a sniper or from, a rocket-propelled grenade. Somebody hiding nearby. Somebody hiding in the rubble. People popping out of a tunnel and going back in. There's a million eventualities of what could have happened. We just don't know.
Alberto, just to pull back a little bit, the West Bank, there's been a town in the West Bank where there's been Jewish settlers attacking Christians there. I know that's been a very contentious situation. What's going on?
Well, this is the town of Taibe, or the village of Taibe in the West Bank. It's the only entirely Christian village left on the West Bank. It's part Orthodox, part Roman Latin Catholic, as they call them in the East, and part Melkite Catholic. It has three churches and three priests. It's also very famous for its excellent beer, and they do an Oktoberfest, a beer festival, every year. But there is, you know, settler activity on the West Bank where Israeli settlers are engaged in this kind of low-level conflict over land and over property against Palestinian villages. And this is happening in general in many places. It just happens that they've set their sight on this one village, which is the only remaining Christian village left in all of the West Bank. You know, there are areas where Christians traditionally lived, like Bethlehem, obviously, or Ramallah, where there are still Christian communities, but they are a minority in these places that were once majority Christian towns or villages.
Yeah, talking about the Israelis, the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, how stable is it at this point politically?
It's extremely unstable. Prime Minister Netanyahu has some legal issues, you know, dating back, you know, questions, governance issues. That's one thing. But then he faces the problem that his is a coalition government, and it's an unstable coalition government, as they tend to be, with people with different agendas. People who may be more hawkish or more dovish on something, people who are more secular or more religious, which is a very big question in Israel among Israeli Jews. And so the government itself is very unstable. It's a war cabinet. They're fighting, obviously, Iran and its adversaries. We're fighting Israel on 5-6 fronts. And while the Iran front is quiet now, there, you know, the Syria front and the Lebanon front and the Yemen front and the Gaza front are still active. So four of them, you know, there are Israeli soldiers looking in four different directions at what the adversary is going to do.
Well, I know there's a lot to cover, and there will be even more to cover in the coming weeks and months. Alberto, just very grateful that you're here to provide this analysis.
Thank you so much, and God bless.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be joined by senior editor Jonathan Liedl to talk about a theological term, deification. You're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Don't go anywhere.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, your host, along with the co-host, Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, it isn't every day that complex, even abstruse theological concepts emerge in exciting ways in common discussions. But Register senior editor Jonathan Liedl has just completed a fascinating survey on theosis. What is theosis, or deification, you ask? Well, Jonathan is here to explain it and to tell us why it is so interesting to theologians today. Jonathan, welcome back to Register Radio.
Great to be with you guys.
Well, I remember when there was the initial discussions about doing a piece on deification, and I was excited. But I know for a lot of people, this is one of those words that sounds a little intimidating.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, in my reporting, we kind of began with exactly that experience of a young woman I was put in contact with, Grace Simcock. She's a theology student at Franciscan University. And she said she came across this idea of deification, which, you know, is also called divinization or theosis, last year while talking to someone who's now her boyfriend. And he was an Eastern Orthodox catechumen, right? So a member of the Orthodox Church. And when they were talking about what it means to be a Christian, he kept on coming back to this idea that the Christian life is aimed at theosis, is aimed at becoming like God.
That's quite the icebreaker, by the way.
And so Grace told me, yeah, right? Like, hey, first date conversation, like, you know, let's hit the big topics right away. Just get it out of the way. But this idea, becoming like God, being central to the Christian life, she said it struck her at first as provocative and even borderline mythological, right? Like, are we talking about something Christian, or are we talking about pagan? That sounds almost like, you know, some pagan idea of, you know, Hercules and Zeus and all these, someone becoming a god or something like that. But for her, for Grace, she, you know, this conversation prompted her to kind of look more closely in Scripture, look more closely in the church fathers. And then eventually, you know, she's a theology student at Franciscan. She has a great love of Thomas Aquinas. And she came to the theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, where he writes about Thomas writes, since it was the will of God's only begotten Son that men should share in his divinity, he, Christ, assumed our nature in order that by becoming man, he might make men gods. So that's the language of St. Thomas Aquinas there. So you're right, this language of deification, becoming like God, can seem kind of out of nowhere, or unsettling, or a little different than typical ways that salvation has been presented in the Catholic Church in recent centuries. But yeah, it's definitely a deep part of our tradition.
So is there even a misunderstanding that this is more of apotheosis? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, is that meaning that the sort of you become absorbed into the divine essence, like the creature,
right,
like the human
exactly.
person, right, ceases to be and is absorbed into God? Yeah, I mean, I think there could be some versions of talking about deification that make that point. But really, the Catholic understanding, which is rooted in Scripture, it's rooted in, you know, church fathers like Augustine, Irenaeus, St. Athanasius, is that we're saved, right? We're saved from sin and participate in heaven by partaking in divine life through grace, right? So it's this becoming like God through participation, not through essence. So we never lose our creaturely status, right? We're always dependent upon God, right? We're always participating in his divinity, never kind of having it on our own. But yeah, I think there, you know, maybe in some Eastern Orthodox circles, there's a danger of that. But the Catholic scholars I've talked to, certainly, you know, one of them, Father Andrew Horfer, who's a Dominican, he said some people in Catholic circles are hesitant to say like God or to talk about deification. But he says we do it because Christ did it. And we do it because the church fathers did it. So it needs clarification, it needs precision, but it's a part of the patrimony of the church that has really been sort of recovered in a really interesting way over the past century.
You know, let's talk about that. So whether we as Catholics understand individually what this is all about, we as a church believe this, right? And you said in your piece that it wasn't that this has been forgotten, but it has been overshadowed. How so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if we think of salvation, I think, you know, there's definitely a major understanding that salvation is about being saved from something, right? So it's about being saved from hell. It's about being saved from our guilt that we contract via sin, right? So that's a big emphasis in the Bible, certainly, and in Catholic theologies of salvation. And that's often described as sort of juridical, referring to law, referring to almost like a courtroom dynamic, like a debt that needs to be paid. That's one understanding of salvation. But I think we can also, you're saved from something, but you're saved for something too. And so that's where this deification language comes in. What you're saved for ultimately is friendship with God, is participation in God's life, and to become like God, right? And so I think, you know, in the maybe beginning with someone like St. Anselm of Canterbury, and then kind of in the 1200s, and then, you know, really being cemented with the Reformation and Catholic responses to Protestants, this juridical language, right? This emphasis on salvation being about a debt being paid, about avoiding punishment, really became kind of sort of like the overarching way in which a lot of Catholics thought about salvation. So that more positive emphasis, right, that I'm saved for something, I'm saved for participation in God's life and union with him, was somewhat maybe overshadowed. But it, of course, it never went away. So in the 20th century, and even before that, with people like John Henry Newman and Matthias Schaben, there begins to be a recovery of this. And a lot of it had to do with what's called ressourcement, which is a theological movement in the 20th century, where you had, you know, figures like Henri de Lubac, Joseph Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict XVI, who said, you know, we're going to go back to some of those early church fathers, right? These figures we've mentioned, Athanasius, Irenaeus, and we're going to look more closely about how they talked about things like salvation. And in doing so, there was this recovery, right, of this emphasis on, yes, we're saved from sin, but we're saved for union with God, right? And that through, you know, ecumenical dialogue with Orthodox Christians in the latter half of the 20th century really kind of has kind of helped this recovery of the language of deification. And we really kind of have now reached, I think, kind of some important milestones in that recovery.
Now, you note the role of this theological concept in certain Eastern theology. What are the... You just used that word. What are the ecumenical ramifications for a deeper understanding in terms of the West of theosis?
Yeah, well, this is something that our Eastern brethren, whether Orthodox or Eastern Catholics, like deification has in many ways been at the heart of their theological tradition throughout the centuries. So the Catholic recovery of deification theology presents another opportunity for Orthodox and Catholics to say, hey, this is something that we both believe in, that we can kind of stand on together, and it can serve as a path forward as we explore what it means to grow deeper in unity. There are different emphases within the Orthodox expression of deification and the Catholic, but there definitely is a common core. And so an exciting development that's taking shape right now is we can actually expect a joint declaration on the doctrine of deification from Catholic and Orthodox scholars and bishops. It's something that is in the works right now, and it's really born out of this this Oxford Handbook on Deification that was published a year ago, which is an 800-page big textbook that has contributions from 44 different theologians, including some of the leading Catholic theologians in the world, talking about deification. And that's really kind of synthesizing all this development we've been talking about and then laying a foundation for moving forward. And so the people who are involved in that said, you know, this was a really fertile experience between Catholics and Orthodox, and we think a joint declaration could be another step forward, another way of us, you know, kind of rallying around this shared concept in our shared faith with the hope of eventual unification.
Right.
Jonathan, we've only got a few minutes, but let's pivot to another topic that is also, some still feel, is obscure, which is
more than deification,
which is synodality. Yeah. Maybe not on the same level, but synodality, right? So just bring us up to date. I know you're keeping a watch on Pope Leo. Briefly, again, since we only have a couple of minutes, where are we at with synodality, and what's set to happen next?
Yeah, so obviously Pope Leo's election, he has given every indication that he plans to carry on the synodal reforms that Pope Francis began. He's mentioned it frequently in speeches. We just had a couple weeks ago the Ordinary Council of Bishops, so the small exclusive group of international bishops, meet in Rome to kind of chart the path forward for synodality. That included Bishop Daniel Flores, a figure, a bishop from Texas, who's played a really important role in all of this. But yeah, we're now looking to 2028, right? Before we were looking to 2024 and the synodal assembly that was going to kind of, you know, culminate with, you know, some ways to make the church more synodal. But now we're looking to 2028, when there's going to be a look back at how the dioceses of the world have implemented, you know, what's called synodality. And I think there's certainly questions still about what is synodality. I really thought of that when we were in Rome in 2024, that it was really the synod on synodalities, meaning there are different definitions, concepts of synodality almost competing with each other. One is a kind of egalitarianism. Another is more an emphasis on, you know, the church is one body with different parts, though. How do they fit together? And so I think that's something a lot of people are hoping that Pope Leo will continue to clarify, is what exactly do we mean by synodality? I, in particular, I'm really interested in Bishop Daniel Flores, because he's this figure deeply grounded in St. Thomas Aquinas, who oftentimes talks about synodality much more clearly and much more in continuity with church doctrine than the Vatican does itself. So there, we've got a few more years to hopefully work out some of those kinks, but I know a lot of us are looking to see what kind of role Bishop Flores is going to play in that.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting fall and winter, I suspect. Well, Jonathan, thank you
so much.
It
always is.
And I loved your piece. You can find it at ncregister.com. Well, that's it.
Thanks so
much for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Ace McKay, Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care and God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.